Hello and welcome to Future Library. I'm your host, Alex Botton, and today I'm joined by the first person I've ever spoken to from Reykjavik. I have on the line, on the internet, I'm not sure which one it would be, on Skype, I'm speaking to Ulva Eldian of Apparat Organ Quartet and Ulva Eldian solo music fame. How are you doing, Ulva?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Firstly, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very excited to be speaking to you because I very much like Apparat Organ Quartet. I'm not so familiar with your solo work, and I feel a bit bad about that. But
No, sorry. That's okay. That's perfectly fine.
I will learn more about that, and I will delve into all that. I've got it up on my iPad in front of me, information about your solo work, and I've got the band's website up on another screen.
Yeah, you can Google my solo work and just pretend that you know it. So
I actually have to confess, I have done that in the past.
Yeah.
Shows, and I've read things out about them, going, yes, and of course you did this, and I'm kind of just reading it off a screen. So obviously I kind of know your music a little bit. Probably the best thing to do, rather than me going into, and this is, I'm going to kind of interrupt myself at this point. Yeah. I do this every episode. I say exactly the same thing, and I'm very aware that I do it, so I do apologise, listeners. But you're going to hear exactly the same words come out of my mouth as do every time. But rather than me telling the listeners a bit about yourself, tell us a bit about yourself, Ulfa.
Okay. Yes, where should I start? I can tell you about my band.
Anywhere you like,
Quartet. Yeah. So, Apparat Organ Quartet is actually a quite old band by now, because we started in 1999, the last century.
Yeah, last century.
Or the last millennium, basically. So
that sounds even
so
better.
We're like, yeah. So, and we're, like the name implies, we're an organ quartet. We started out as an organ quartet of four organ players. We used to perform on these like gigantic organs that we had. And back then, it was like mostly improvised and slightly low-key, slightly experimental music. And we started playing together, and as it developed, we added a live drummer to it, and the songs started to take more of a form, or we started writing songs instead of just doing like long improvisations and that kind of hippie stuff. And eventually, we sort of came up with a formula that we were pleased with, using a lot of vocoders and vocaloids for singing, and a pretty interesting collection of old and strange keyboards. And then we have like the it's like our secret weapon is the drummer that has a kind of a punk and metal background. And which gives us a bit of a twist. But yeah, the members of Apparat Organ Quartet are like, we're actually four now. We used to be the world's only five-piece quartet. But since then, Johan Johansson has actually left the band. And so there's three keyboard players left, and the drummer, and we have a kind of, I think the other three, they actually all have a background in the visual arts, which is kind of strange for me. So, you're still there?
Yeah, Alex? I am still here, yes.
Yeah, great.
Yes, just
stop me if I've gone down the wrong path.
No.
So, yes, we come from, well, Hörður, who's the oldest member of the group, he's more than 50 by now. His background is quite interesting because he used to be a professional church organist at a time. For several years, he was a church organist in Reykjavik. But before that time, he was like part of the most notorious punk and indie bands Iceland has ever seen. So notorious that they got arrested and charged for breaking various laws, you know, after some of their performances.
I have to say, the thing is that from the outside, Iceland looks kind of very, very liberal. So I'm kind of guessing, I'm thinking, what could they have done to get arrested in Iceland?
Oh, let's not get too deep into that. But this was like the punk era,
yeah.
And it was there was a band that had a really, it was, they did a lot of, it was like an art performance band. This was during the punk era in Iceland, which is a really interesting period, because it actually happened a few years later than the bloom of punk in England and the rest of the world. There was this kind of crossover between, it was happening at the same time, this kind of new age, you know, like everything was happening at the same time. There were punk bands in the spirit of Sex Pistols and The Clash and whatnot. But at the same time, there were like the first synth pop bands and new romantic bands being formed, and this is a scene that's like has been really influenced a lot of people who are slightly younger, like me and Sighvatur from Apparat and others. And this is like the scene where people like Björk were. Björk was her band, was her first band, was a big part of this scene, for example. And yes, please stop me.
Well, I was going to say, it does seem from looking from the outside of. I'm trying to get my words together. From the outside of Iceland, it does look very much like it's a very artistic place, because you've got a fairly small population, haven't you?
Oh, yes. There's like, we're roughly 300,000, 330,000,
wow.
I think. It's like, a street in London? No.
Well, it's for listeners in the UK, to give you a sense of scale, that is two of the city of Dundee in Scotland.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
Which is the fifth smallest city, or the fifth biggest city, I should say. But it might be the fifth smallest, I don't know. The fifth biggest city in Scotland, which itself isn't particularly hugely populated. So you've got quite a sort of... So does it mean that there's no real kind of avoiding bumping into other artists if you're working in various ways?
No, there's no way you're going to avoid it. It's like living in a small town, basically. Mm-hmm. And it has some really nice advantages. And of course, it's also got its disadvantages. But I think what people usually will tell you that there's the gap is so small between the different kinds of music and the different generations, and so I think that thing is coming to a fruition right now, because we're getting really, we're seeing, you know, almost no boundaries between, you know, classical music and pop and rock and indie and I mean, you know most of these people by name.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be really interesting that there's also this thing that people are sometimes doing many things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They're like in a one punk band and then they play the second violin in the symphony orchestra, and and they also, there's always been this kind of mentality that you can, maybe because we are so few and we really want to have the kind of standard that we see in bigger nations. So, I mean, I guess you can be in three bands to make it work out.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take a guess that, like everywhere else in the world, there aren't enough drummers.
No, well, actually, I think there are so many drummers here, and
that's where they all are. They're all in.
Well, they are all here, but also there's like the best drummers. They seem to be in like million bands.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a big thing. I can think of at least 2-3 guys I know, and they are all drumming with really different projects, which kind of maybe that's the thing that makes them so good. But there's also it's a really small scene, and it has all these nice things about it, but of course it has the disadvantages that maybe it's not critical enough.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that's an advantage too, I don't know, but maybe it's sometimes, you know, it's a bit difficult to be critical of because everyone is so close to each other somehow. But what's also really interesting, and, you know, people usually they just mention how few we are, but the really interesting thing for me about the Icelandic music scene is that there's almost no musical history before the 20th century in Iceland.
Right.
So basically before the 20th century, we have like such a primitive society back then. It's like a pretty poor colony to Denmark and a farming society, and there were hardly any instruments. Most of them had to do with church music.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have some folk music, which is mostly vocal and very primitive. So in Iceland, we don't have the kind of you know, many hundred years of classical music on our shoulders, and then there's a lot of modernization that happened in the 20th century. So all of a sudden, there are so many, you know, musicians, educated or self-made musicians, and they all have like this empty table in front of them, and so there's like lots of opportunities. I mean, it's like you can still be the first Mozart of Iceland, and you know what I mean.
It sounds absolutely ideal, because I think it sounds. I've been in the kind of middling sized city kind of experience before, which is the only thing I can think of that would, you know, even equate to the same kind of music scene. And it's actually the reason I mentioned Dundee, because I used to live there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, okay.
There's that. Because that as a city was slightly isolated, and that you knew the music press were never going to come there or anything like that.
Right.
There was a sense that the bands stopped worrying about whether they were ever going to be kind of in quotes successful, and
exactly.
Just got on with doing what they wanted to do. And you had, like you've said, that kind of cross-generational playing, where you had guys who'd come up through punk, were playing with people in their 20s and teens, and there was nothing weird seen about it. It was just like, that's what you do. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think it can be really nice. I think it could be nice that everybody knows everybody, you know, and you can go out for a walk, and you'll almost certainly, if you're in a built-up area, bump into somebody you know. But on the other hand, I guess if you fall out with people, it can be...
Yes, that can be quite interesting too.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's also really good to be an outsider in a small community. I mean, it's even if you really want to be like one against all the others, that's quite easy too. But because everyone is going to notice you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the thing. It's so easy to get noticed. It's like the easiest thing in the world is to become world famous in Iceland. It's almost like a saying. It's like you can, it's so easy to get on the front page of a of a newspaper or make a headline in the news or be like a known name. And there was many years ago, there was someone who made a point of this, and he just made a point of demonstrating that you could be famous for nothing in Iceland. And he just, you know, told some press people that he would like to become famous, but that he had no talent and there was nothing, you know, remarkable about him. But within a week, I think all of the major, you know, newspapers and news channels and everyone had picked up on him because this was just the guy that wanted to be famous without having a reason to be famous. And
that's enough of a hook, isn't it?
Yeah. That was just, that's enough.
Whereas in the UK, we've got so many people who want to be famous just for the sake of being famous, that it kind of doesn't have, from what you're describing there, it's kind of, it seems to me that there's a kind of creative, almost artistic statement being made there, whereas in the UK it's just people who can't think of anything else to do and think, oh, I'll marry a footballer or I'll go on the X Factor and get famous that way. So it's kind of, so even the people who want to be famous for being famous have got kind of a conceptual thing going on. So no, it sounds like an artistic paradise.
Oh yeah, if you want to be famous, come to Iceland. But so if you want to be rich and famous, go somewhere else, I think.
Well, you know, who wants to be rich and famous?
Well, no, you can't have best of both worlds, no.
No. I was trying to think of anybody who was, but... No.
Well, rich, famous and happy.
There's three, isn't it, that you're looking for? Yeah. If you get all three of them. But I can't think of anybody. Well, I don't know any of them personally, though. I mean, maybe Bono is really happy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe. Is he happy?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, he's surfing on his own smugness, so...
Yeah.
Maybe he could have just looks in the mirror every morning and goes, hey, you're Bono, every day.
Yeah. And okay, so that's like a thing. I think that Bono was here in New Year's Eve in Iceland, and like my feed on Facebook that night was like, you know, so many people that I know taking pictures of them with Bono. And it was like, yeah, he was like a... And he was like showing up in different parties, it seemed to be downtown in Reykjavik. So I guess he knows how to have fun still.
Yeah, I think that's the impression I get from him. And it's weird, the whole thing with U2, and I'm speaking of somebody who was, when I was a teenager, I was a big U2 fan, and then I've kind of gone off U2 over the years. And then I've kind of found
myself...
Oh, yeah,
same thing here.
You know, and I found myself kind of weirdly grudgingly respecting them for kind of trudging on year after year.
Right.
But there was that weird period about 10, 12 years ago where they seemed to be slightly more kind of interesting than people like R.E. and stuff. They seem to actually have slightly more they were getting more critical acclaim for their work, and it's good thinking, how did that happen? Is this what happens? If you just trudge on forever, does it cycle round that every now and then you become, you know, seen as being good for a short while?
Yeah, you know, sure, that definitely happens.
Yeah,
I mean, that's like Bruce Springsteen, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I don't know. Maybe 10 years ago, he was totally not cool.
Yeah.
But he's been doing the same thing since he started, and now he's back to being cool again. Yeah. I guess.
Well, I mean, you look at the actor Matthew McConaughey, who for years made horrible, horrible films, and then has been in a couple of things like Killer Joe, and the one about, I can't remember what it's about, what the name is, it's something to do with real estate in Texas somewhere, and then he's done True Detective, and everybody's talking about how he's like this great actor. It's like, yeah, he's made a right turn into being good. Unexpectedly. And I think occasionally that happens, so that's, we've actually gone quite a long way just talking about one member of the band there.
So
he went from punk to being a church organist to being a member of Apparat Organ Quartet.
Yes.
So
and that was like a common interest with all of us, that I had done some, you know, some entertaining with just showing up with like this small Casio keyboard and trying to perform for people who wanted to dance and stuff, really, really kind of kitsch, kitsch thing that I was doing. And Sigvatur, the which I haven't mentioned a lot, he had the same kind of, he also had like a solo career going on. It's like really underground, this one guy with a home organ, and under the name of Musikvatur, and then of course Johan, and the four of us connected through being, you know, we didn't really know each other at all when we started this project. So, and But it turned out that it was the most interesting band that I think any of us had been in, because we'd gotten rid of all the guitars and bass players and singers that steal all the attention from the keyboard player. And it was, that was really liberating. But the thing is that we found that we really needed a live drummer after trying out, you know, drum machines, or because we didn't want to get into the programmed kind of music. And that's maybe one of the things that makes us slightly unique, is that we've been playing electronic music, but it's all hand played. And every time we try to do something sequenced or break this rule, it doesn't really turn out really well.
Well, I think it's really interesting the way that you do that, because the first thing I kind of, because the first album of yours I heard was Polyphonia, and hearing that, it's kind of this odd experience for me, because it was kind of tickling my liking for electronica and electronic music and all that kind of stuff. But it was also kind of tickling the little part of me that was, you know, the younger version of myself that had liked rock music. And
right.
It was the most kind of rocking record I'd heard for a very long time. And there was just, you know, it kind of had that effect of the live band, but the electronic live band. And it's, you know, which is what made me go, ooh, this is good. And, I think a good call having a proper drummer.
Yeah, and that's also, I think that we really like performing live, although we don't do it very often. But I think a lot of our fans, at least, have said that they got into the band through a live performance. I don't know if it's I mean, definitely it can stand on its own as the records stand on their own. But I think that what we're always trying to do and we've had a little bit of problems with it, actually, when we're recording and working on the albums, that we're trying to bring the kind of the live act into the studio. Because, like I said, we have a lot of old and strange gear with us, and the live performances can get quite exciting, because if things start breaking down or behaving strangely, it has a kind of a dangerous element to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen a little bit of footage on YouTube of a few things, and one of the ones that I thought was really interesting was being able to see kind of up close what you were doing. I think it was something you'd done for a radio show in the States. And
KXP.
That was you as the quartet rather than the five of you. And it's really interesting to watch, because for listeners who aren't familiar with the music, when you listen to it on the records, it you'd think that some of this playing was kind of sequenced, because it's very very tight, and then you see it played and you just think, Christ, that's really complicated. And it's like, because there's always switching between things and playing two different keyboards at once, and I can imagine
it's all trickery. It's not complicated at all.
Does it just look complicated?
that's a good thing about being a keyboard player. It's like, you know no one can really tell if you're playing something really difficult or not.
Because it all looks difficult, so...
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's the exact opposite of doing a laptop show, where it looks really easy, and what you're actually doing is doing a lot of concentrating and making decisions on the fly.
You have to be really good at pretending, you know, if you're playing a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so easy with a keyboard, you know. But actually, we have also... We have, like, practiced at some point. We have actually practiced our expressions, that, like, there's the expression of playing something really difficult, and then there's the my favorite expression, which I use sparingly these days, but it's still my favorite, which is the show-off expression. It's very good for live shows, maybe not as good for these kind of live internet video sessions, but it's really good for you know, look at the look at me, I'm playing something difficult expression. So it might be part of that. It might be fooling you.
Is it almost like the kind of, because when you're describing the look at me kind of expression, I'm getting a mental image of Derek Smalls from Spinal Tap with his arm up whilst playing, you know, a single note on his bass, but punching the air while he's doing it.
Maybe not that tongue in cheek. I mean, it's like, but that's the thing that we've been exploring is the stage presence of a keyboard player, because, you know, keyboard players, they've always been slightly handicapped because they can't move around mm-hmm. the stage. So you have, you know, characters like Keith Emerson, who started like wearing ridiculous outfits to, you know, get more attention.
And Brian Eno as well.
That's trying to steal the attention because you can't do the same kind of cool moves. And so we had this problem or this challenge also of being four stationary guys on a stage and not too interesting to look at, and we didn't also want to go too much into the Kraftwerk mm-hmm. direction, although they're of course a great influence. But so what we started writing these dance routines, which are also can be a big part of the show. They're for some songs, but they have like they're a great way of communicating with the audience,
mm-hmm.
and like really simple dance routines with lots of meaning behind it that everyone can participate in. And but still not, it's not the kind of fascist thing, you know. They are like really nice and cheerful routines. And like spelling the name of the band or just like slightly, you know, doing the lyrics, explaining the lyrics slightly.
It makes me think of, I can't remember which one of the two it is. It's one of the male brothers from Sparks. Little bits of footage I've seen over the years, the keyboard playing guy, obviously. He would always be kind of very stationary, and then occasionally he'd just burst out with some unexpected dance move and then go straight back and be completely as if nothing had happened. So I have to see you guys play at some point.
Oh yeah. He's so funny. Actually, we don't try to be that funny. If we're funny, it just happens because we can't help it or because mm-hmm. we're ridiculous. But we don't want to make, we're pretty serious about it though. Mm-hmm. But I really love the guy from Sparks. Have you seen the, where he's using the ridiculously long hands? That's like my favorite bit. It's like, you find it on YouTube.
I will
like,
have to look that up. I will make a note of that. So good. Sparks, long hands.
Yeah, definitely.
I should definitely write keywords. But it's kind of interesting. I think one of the things that leapt out about you guys was the way that you'd come from improvising into more structured music, which seemed to me to be kind of almost the exact opposite of a lot of musicians I know, because a lot of people mm-hmm. I know kind of started out, you know, when they were younger, they start playing in bands and doing all the rehearsing and stuff and playing structured stuff. And as they get older, they get less interested in doing that and start going off and just improvising stuff, or they give up altogether and go and work in a bank or something. And I thought it was kind of interesting that you'd gone the other way, that, you know, because I found that because I'm a musician as well, and I found that as I've gone along, I've got less and less interested in playing structured stuff purely because I don't have the patience to rehearse.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah. Whereas, you know, watching the way you guys are working, you make it look like a lot of fun to do. And there's obviously a lot of skill going on there, you know, being able to play and being able to write the way you do. There's a sense of, that it looks like you enjoy playing together as a band and enjoy playing these pieces of music.
Yeah, I think it's also just that way that we've been synchronizing together over the years. So it's really pleasing to play together now. And maybe I think that what we like about doing really structured stuff is that we still have a lot of freedom. You're never going to get at a live show. You're never going to get, even though we have the exactly same structure over and over again, it's never going to sound exactly the same because mm-hmm. it's so, what should I say? it's so risky at time. So many things that can go out of balance, and it's nice when it happens, actually.
Well, I'm guessing if you're using kind of older gear, you've got the risk of things wandering off pitch and
yes.
filters doing odd things and never being able to get the same sound twice out of it. Or yeah. anything like that.
That's part of the excitement, but actually we sort of, nowadays we don't use that much of the most... the oldest gear we leave in the studio, mainly because we don't want it, you know, breaking down mm-hmm. forever. But there's a lot of excitement that comes from this. And I think that many ideas for songs are born when we have a new toy to play with mm-hmm. and we turn it on maybe for the first time and just something happens. And we've always tried to approach, you know, songwriting thinking that the instruments are a part of the songwriting mm-hmm. process, you know. What happens if I turn this on and what kind of... I mean, I think like Sigvaldur, he has this one old Soviet synthesizer that we don't understand half of what the buttons on it, and it seems to be completely out of control at times. And every time we turn it on, something... interesting happens, just something really random, and it can be such a that's where we get a lot of inspiration from, and also kind of finding these defects that are nice, yeah. musically nice defects.
Yeah, the kind of it's the little happy accidents, isn't it? The
yeah,
kind of send you off in a different direction to maybe you kind of maybe you've intended to go, and then it happens, and you go, oh, I like that better. I'm going to go that
way. Oh, right.
Yeah. That's...
And then we also, I mean, it's also about, I mean, we haven't moved away from improvisation. We sometimes do like smaller, you know, gigs or happenings mm-hmm. where we're just improvising, and we've done it under different names also. Ah. So, but it's for us today, it's also just a really nice way to work on ideas, to do these low-key improvised sets. Mm-hmm. And... sometimes maybe from 1 hour of improvising this, there's suddenly maybe just one idea, but it's a really good idea that mm-hmm. we couldn't have had without it. And I've started doing this also for my solo stuff. I've started to do also like really improvised sets where I just have one instrument and a laptop, and I just approach it not like I'm improvising, but like I'm writing a song live, mm-hmm. or yeah. trying to,
yeah.
doing my best
yes.
to make a convincing song. And this has been like really, I've done this a few times and at public events, or maybe 1 hour, and it's incredible how different your brain works when you're under the pressure of performing mm-hmm. something and writing something spontaneously. And it's like you get so many structured ideas out of it, whereas if you sit down in your studio and you can try for a whole day to come up with something good, then it doesn't happen just because you're under a different kind of pressure, you know.
Yeah, I think it's almost I mean, from my experience, I think it's almost in the live setting I find that there seems to be part of the decision-making process gets kind of completely bypassed for me.
Right.
It's like, yeah. I feel that there's not time for like my conscious mind to decide what to do. So I just have to let my subconscious or whatever's piloting me at the time make the decisions and just trust that they'll be okay. Because it's making, you know, it's almost like you've made the decision before you realize you've done it. You've done it and you've gone, oh, I've just done that. Oh.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a completely different experience. It's interesting you mentioned your solo work. You should tell us a little bit about that, because I can see, looking at your website, that it seems to take a very different kind of direction to the band.
In some ways. I try to... It's mainly, you know, originally stuff that I had been writing for theaters and, you know, and some film music and stuff like that. And I've been sort of always working on the side on that, but I'm doing a lot more of it now. So actually, I'm working on a proper solo album now. I've already put out two records, which are more kind of soundtrack or experimentally based. But right now, I'm actually working on an album that is a little bit in between the film music I've been doing and Apparat organ quartet. Mm-hmm. So I'm combining actually the some analog synths and electronic sources with I have like a string quartet, and then I have a great percussionist Samuli Kosminen, who's the drummer in Icelandic band Moom, for example, mm-hmm. and many other really nice projects, and my little brother Haldur, who's also in a great band in Iceland called Sigur. He's also been helping me out, and so that's what I'm working on right now. And also, I'm going into, I've been dabbling with a more kind of technical, kind of interactive music concepts,
mm-hmm.
and I'm working on, and I hope to release it quite soon. It's like it's an interactive string quartet that's called the Eternal String Quartet, and that's something that's going to be a listening experience which you have online in a pretty simple graphic interface. Mm-hmm. A composition made out of a lot of elements which you can put together in the way you like. And that's maybe a little bit closer to kind of avant-garde or quote-unquote serious music.
Mm-hmm. But it's a nice idea. I mean, I'm kind of looking at, is that the, I've got this on the works here, is that the string quartet number?
Yeah, yeah.
The infinity.
Probably have like really old information about it there.
it's a nice idea that the whole kind of like lots of little, I mean, you worded it here as modules that you can kind of swap around. I think that's a really nice idea. I think it's something that currently shuffled.
Oh, you went on hold for a short while.
I was going to say, it's something that could be infinitely shuffled, and
The thing.
Yeah, and I think there's space for that in people's lives now, because music's so ubiquitous around us, and you know, whether they've got headphones on, or people are sitting at the back of the bus with the tinny speakers of their iPhones or whatever.
Definitely. I'm really interested in that, and it's partly that, and it's partly the kind of, you know, the music industry stubbornness, you know, for the stereo mix, trying to sell a stereo mix to people who don't want to pay anymore for mm-hmm. it. Although I don't agree that it should be free, but but I think that there are so many, you know, great things about the technology that we have in our hands, and I thought for a long time that it's really strange that you know, the industry hasn't been using the opportunities more to create new formats or new listening experiences. Mm-hmm. Although this is highly, you know, experimental, and I'm not sure if I'm going to fail miserably with my work, but it's a nice territory. And I also like this idea about, like you said, people with headphones,
mm-hmm.
that all of a sudden we have this new kind of experience which is so individual. It's such a private experience, and you're starting to interact with music in new ways, and mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. Not something that should replace, you know, concerts or other forms, but it's just a new dimension, and mm-hmm. for me it's the most interesting development that has happened in music over the last, you know, years.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely, I mean, with the collapse almost of the record industry and the way that technology has just developed almost kind of exponentially over the last 20 years, it's reaching a point where it's almost to my mind, almost impossible to guess where technology is going to go next for music. And this very odd attitude of the record industry of trying to hold on to a model that just isn't viable at all anymore. People aren't expecting to pay for music. And as you say, I think there should be a certain amount of the artists being rewarded for what they're doing, because otherwise you just can't keep on doing it. And it's trying to work out a balance between people who don't expect to pay and people who need to be paid to do it. And how does that balance out? I mean, the other thing as well is with the experience with headphones. I mean, I find as I've got older, I mean, when I was younger, I'd listen to everything at full volume and everybody around me would be able to hear it through my headphones as well.
Yeah.
Partly because it was back in the days of kind of those foam covered earphones that kind of sat on your ear and didn't go in. And as I've got older, I've kind of turned down a lot. And I kind of let a lot of background noise seep in as well.
Yeah.
So I find it peculiar listening to music when it's very quiet and all I'm hearing is the music. I find that very odd now because I've got so used to letting the background sounds become part of it.
And that's right.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if there's a whole generation now growing up where that is their normal experience, that music is something that is part of the background sound, part of the environment that they're in, rather than being a separate thing or a separate little kind of sound world that they immerse themselves in. So it's...
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I mean, and there's also, of course, this has been since the Walkman, but I mean, it started with the Walkman, this one of the really, this idea of private listening. For example, going into a landscape or going into as a tourist into a big city where you know no one, and you have this private soundtrack in your ears, and that's a really interesting idea for me. But I also think it's I think like in music history, there are always been some technological advances that push things ideologically into a new direction. So and I think that technology has is slightly underrated in the development of music. I mean, there's like a lot of classical composers who were obsessed with technology. Like, I mean, Beethoven, he was like constantly writing to the piano manufacturers, you know, getting them to push the boundaries of what the instruments could do. He wanted louder, more expressive pianos, and I mean the gimmicks. I mean a lot of the old classical music is very gimmicky if you think about it. This thing about Tchaikovsky when he discovered the celesta and had the first celesta imported into Russia, and it had to be a complete secret. And until the premiere of the piece, so it was like bringing a new synth to a concert that no one has heard about.
And I guess that's something that's kind of lost when you kind of, after the years have gone by, and you kind of lose the context of the time. And people look back and go, oh, that was proper music back then. And as you say, what those musicians were doing was for them was really the cutting edge of the most modern stuff they could do, and they were really pushing the boundaries. I mean, I'm guessing it would go back, you know, even as far as people like Talis and Allegri and all those kind of people. There's elements you hear in the music of people kind of clearly showing off of what they could do.
Yes, definitely. And
you know, we look, and people, there's a whole kind of movement of people that could go, oh, well, you know, our music's not like that anymore. But I think maybe, if anything, music nowadays is maybe more conservative because it isn't trying to push forward like those people. It is at the edges, but in the mainstream, it's you know.
Well, it's also the thing about the stereo mix is that it's really flat. Of course, there's always some kind of interaction, but it's the minimum kind of interaction you have because, I mean, quoting classical history again, I mean, there before, you know, the records, music used to be released as, you know, in notes. So you would, for home performances, and that's a really interactive way of enjoying music. So I guess that with the technology we have, we can sort of revisit that kind of thinking also, or church music, where you obviously participate in creating the soundtrack But at the same time, you're being played or you're being surprised. You don't know how this machine at the back of the church really works. Mm-hmm. It's like a miracle.
And it also makes me think of, you know, all these home performances. How many of these home performances happened over the years where people were getting the cadence wrong, or they were slightly off with the rhythm, so they were playing a piece that didn't quite fit properly. There's a really nice scene in the 90s version of Jeeves and Wooster that was made on British TV that had Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie in it, where Hugh Laurie as Bertie Wooster is trying to play, I think it's the song that's that, hidey, 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 ho, hidey. He's trying to play that, and he can't get the correct meter for the lyrics. He can't get it to fit, and he's trying to sing it. He's going, oh, Jeeves, I think this man's made a terrible error with the way he's written this. It just doesn't fit. And Jeeves is like, I think you need to try it this way, sir. I can imagine all these people trying to, you know, things that we now take for granted because we can hear a recording of how it should sound. They didn't have that, so it was dependent on their ability to read the music, to understand the notation and instructions given by the person who'd written it, depending on what quality of the sheet music was like. So there must have been a lot of different versions of things that were just wrong. But, you know, maybe those were better. Some of those may have been so good, and those are lost completely and never will be heard. And, yeah, I think maybe we've lost that a little bit because we can recreate things so perfectly almost now.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming quite generic. It's hard to get out of the stereo mix sound.
Yeah.
Although I'm not saying that I'm any better, but I think we have to try to find some ways out of it. You know, there's a dead end in all that compression and all that standardized way that we mix drums and vocals together.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to become really generic, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think one of the things that I like about the way you guys use things like the Vocaloid and the vocoder and stuff is that you're allowing that kind of slightly more primitive version of autotune almost to have the little mistakes and have the little kind of glitches that those things had. And it's far more kind of robotic sounding, which weirdly now compared to autotune is actually sounding more human.
Yes.
It's a very odd
thing. They're really nice, the Vocaloids. So we've used both. I mean, vocoders are, of course, old technology by now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are many decades since it was invented, and the technology hasn't really gotten any better. You still get the best-sounding vocoders are from the middle of the last century or slightly later. But then we have the Vocaloid, which is a big thing in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how aware people are of this, but Vocaloids are, of course, like just like artificial voices, computer-generated singers. And in Japan, they have some Vocaloids which are celebrities by now.
Yeah.
So they have like a name and a personality, and they have a following just like a pop star, and then they maybe have like a face that's just like a manga drawing of this character, but they're being sort of worshipped just like living pop stars.
And the thing about it is it's quite a human sound. I mean, the first time I ever heard a Vocaloid was at the end of the... Actually, I think it was all the way through. It was through the soundtrack of the movie Paprika, which is a Japanese movie, which has been seen as... A lot of people have said that it kind of influenced parts of the way Inception was written because it has dreams within dreams and all this kind of stuff.
Yes.
Right. But, I mean, that has Vocaloids featuring very heavily in it. And I remember hearing this sound and going, that's really amazing. I have to look up what that is. So I can see why it's popular, and I guess it's one of those sounds that to maybe kind of ears that aren't used to it would sound a bit peculiar and kind of almost alien, but there's something really, really nice about it, and it adds, certainly on the tracks, on the albums where you guys have used it, it's got that really nice, it sounds joyful, I think that's the way I could describe it.
Yeah, that's a, that's also the strange thing about you know, about science fiction and the you know, all the horrible new technology of the future, that once it happens, it's, it isn't like we imagined it. It's much more likable.
Yeah.
And much more human than we thought.
Yeah.
So,
well, this is, I mean, I kind of think, you know, when you'd see sci-fi films and they'd have, you know, the 21st century, and we'd all have rocket packs and live in silver skyscrapers and be wearing kind of jumpsuits. And the reality is we're still kind of dressing like we did, you know, 50 years ago, and listening to music in the same way. And I think in 100 years' time, people will still be wearing jeans, people will still be wearing Converse, people will still wear T-shirts. I don't think they're gonna, things are going to change that much in the way we dress, because as a species, we're just the way we are, and we like things to be the same.
And, yeah, you know, of course.
And then the technology kind of creeps up on us. And really, kind of, I occasionally have moments where I kind of stop in the street and go, whoa, and have this kind of moment of kind of almost techno shock, where I go, well, I've got a computer in my pocket that's higher res than my television was 10 years ago and more powerful than my desktop computer was 5 years ago. And I'm connected to the internet, and I can access pretty much all of human knowledge within a second if I want to. And over in that square, there's a colossal television showing the news. And all these things, they just, because they happen so gradually, I think we just don't notice them creeping up on us. But I quite like that. I think it's a really exciting time to be alive at the moment. I think.
Yeah, it's really exciting. But there's also this great contradiction, and I think that's at the heart of what we're doing in Apparat, is that the new technology, the technology is always advancing, but at the same time it's degrading, because like there's a huge wave now of recreating the synthesizers from the 70s, the great, you know, big name synthesizers that are selling for huge amounts now on eBay. Because the thing is that with all the new technology, you're still not able to make better sounding analog synths. And the same thing is like with microphones. I mean, people are still buying vintage microphones from many decades ago. They are still, you know, at the heart of every studio. There have been, you know, improvements, but they're not real improvements, because they still can't beat a vintage Neumann or whatever. And it's the same thing. I mean, it's like with Stradivarius violins. Violins today aren't as good as they were many hundred years ago. Because no one knows how to make such a good violin anymore. They can come pretty close, but, you know, still the most expensive violins and the best you can get are many hundred years old.
Yeah, I think also part of it is that, you know, as technology becomes more consumer-based, and there's that push to cheapen it and make it more available and have a faster turnaround and make profit from it. Whereas, you know, back in the day, these things were built and you would buy a violin that would then last the rest of your life. Now, the manufacturers don't want you to have a violin that will last the rest of your life. They want it to last 5 or 6 years and then for you to buy another violin.
But there's also like a trade secret that are lost, because these things used to be such a, you know, a family tradition that was passed on like from generation to generation, and real some kind of secrets behind it. And it's amazing.
Something gets lost, but it's an odd situation. It's odd that I think I kind of feel fairly kind of optimistic about the future. I'm not one of these people that kind of gets too kind of doom and gloom about it. You know, I'm aware that things could go horribly wrong, but I kind of feel that we always tend to feel our way to the right direction, even when things could go wrong. So I kind of have a generally kind of optimistic vibe. But yeah, I can see that things are some things aren't as good, but then they're being replaced by other things that are completely different. You know, it's like the violins aren't as good, but my computer is lots better.
Yeah, that's the thing. But it's also like with the synths, you know, we have, I mean, the first analog synths, they were supposed to imitate, and they imitated horribly, acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
But so the interesting thing started happening when people used them the wrong way, not trying to mimic a violin, but to create something that was not supposed to come out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's maybe the same thing, that we're at the same stage with the digital things. They've been trying to imitate old analog synthesizers, or they're trying to imitate voices or drums or whatever, and they are coming pretty close to it. But the really interesting thing is doing something different with it. And my question for the future is, you know, is music, are musical instruments the new format of releasing music?
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be, I'm really curious to see it happen. If there's ever going to be like a Beethoven or Beatles figure that creates not songs, but instruments. That's their composition or pop song.
I guess the form that would take would be people, you know, writing apps for things.
Yeah.
You know, and because, you know, what we've got with things like iPads and all these other things is we've got these almost blank slates that we then use software to make virtual machines. And the machines don't really exist, but this one thing we have can be all those machines. And things start getting quite abstract when you think about it that way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, maybe that's the thing. I mean, it's because I think people buy more apps than they buy music. Maybe that is the way things are going. Games are very popular. The interactive side of things is very popular. I think there's going to be a kind of merging of all these things. And I think you're right. It may well be in 10, 20 years' time that all these things are just the same thing.
Yeah. Right?
The interactive experience.
If the kind of biotechnical revolution hasn't happened by then.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to live, you know, when we will have the first kind of biological synthesizers to play on.
That'd be amazing. But,
yeah,
I think on that positive note, I should let you go so you can get on with what's left of your evening. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you so much for coming on. If people want to find out more about your work, where should they go online to look?
I think you just have to Google Apparat Organ Quartet,
mm-hmm.
and then I have a website which. Thank God I never have time to update, but there's a bit of information there, and it's just ulvereltia.com.
And what I'll do is I will put links to both those websites
in the description of the
podcast. Yeah.
The spelling might get, you know, messed up.
When you're trying to explain spellings to people over the internet, it can be quite tricky when people are trying to write it down. Maybe I should go quite hardcore with it, though, and just insist that people have to get it right and let them, and say to them,
yeah.
Right, if you don't get it, you're not finding the information. But I like to be nice to people. So I said to them, go and check the things out. Fantastic music. It's music that is genuinely kind of uplifting as well. And if you're somebody who's into rock music and you think that keyboards aren't for you, you're wrong. Go and listen to Apparat Organ Quartet because they rock harder than most rock bands. And if you're into electronic music and you think that rock music isn't for you, go and listen to Apparat Organ Quartet because they still have the electronica and the rock in, and it works far better than you would expect it to. And it does make me think, why isn't everybody else doing that? So
yeah, good question.
Oh. You're doing right. One last question, though, I will ask you. Is there a new album ever coming along?
Oh, yes. But we're going to be really, you know, careful because... both of our previous albums took a really long time to make.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always announcing them, you know, yeah, it will be ready in 2 months. But then a few years passed. But actually, we're working on new material now. And hopefully, we can release something in the next decade.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be really careful.
I think that would sound about right to me because it was about an 8-year gap between the other two albums, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think these things take as long as they take, and there's plenty to be getting on with the first two records. So, people go and listen to those. And then once you've really got into those, there may be another one coming along before the end of this. Well, not before the end of this decade, maybe by the middle of next decade.
Yeah, yeah. Let's be careful and yeah. promise no more than that.
By the 2020s, when it's sounding really futuristic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But let's say it's going to happen before that.
Excellent. Okay.
Well, okay.
All that's left to say then is thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And all that's left to say then is a big Future Library goodbye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
little bonus bit of music you just heard was Rotations from Ulver's album Field Recordings, Music from the Ether, which was his first full-length solo album. So that's the show. Thanks for listening. Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk, where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening. Thank you.